This is Fresh Air. Decades ago, our guest Tom Wolfe pioneered what became known as new journalism, using techniques of fiction, such as evocative scene descriptions and dialogue, to tell true stories. He used those storytelling methods in his books, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and The Right Stuff. Wolfe turned to fiction in 1987 with the bestseller Bonfire of the Vanities, a sprawling story of social relations and racial tensions in New York City. His subsequent novels are A Man in Full and I Am Charlotte Simmons. Wolfe's new novel, Back to Blood, is set in Miami and deals with racial and ethnic conflict among the city's diverse inhabitants, which include immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, and Russia, as well as the long-established African-American and Anglo communities. Its central character, a young Cuban-American police officer, struggles with his identity after a heroic act on the job makes him a traitor in the eyes of his community. A one-hour documentary about Wolfe's research in Miami, called Tom Wolfe Gets Back to Blood, is airing on some PBS stations. Tom Wolfe spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Tom Wolfe, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When you wrote Bonfire of the Vanities, it was this remarkable picture of social currents in New York, and in your novel, A Man in Full, you took us to Atlanta. This is about Miami. What drew you to South Florida?
I wanted to do a book on immigration. I was thinking of it even when I was doing my last book. At first, I was interested in the Vietnamese in California because they were spreading rapidly, at first around Los Angeles, and then one day I discovered they were up in San Jose, which is Northern California, to an extent that they were now publishing not only the San Jose Mercury, which is an old newspaper, but the Viet Mercury.
Wow.
And I said, hey, there must be a few people around here. But unfortunately, I couldn't speak the language, and it was just one group of immigrants. And then I heard about Florida. The first thing that caught my ear was that Miami is the only city, the only one I can find, in which people from a foreign country with a different language and a different culture have taken over a metropolitan area politically at the voting machine in slightly over one generation. Of course, that's the Cubans.
Right. So you have the Cubans, which are so powerful politically, and I was surprised to read more than half the police force is Cuban, right?
Oh, yes. Slightly more than 50% are Cuban. Another 20% are Latins. They're from somewhere in Latin America. 18% are American black, and just 12% are what is known there as Anglo, really meaning American-born whites. And that pretty well reflects the composition of the population as a whole.
I want to ask you about the central character of this book is a young Cuban named Nestor Camacho. He is on the police force. You want to just give us a little profile of him?
Yeah. Nestor Camacho lives in Hialeah, in one of these little casitas, with his parents and his grandparents. His older siblings have, by getting married, moved out of the house. And he is a young policeman. He was actually a pretty modest, conscientious policeman. He turned out to be pretty good, and he seemed to be pretty steady in tough, dangerous situations. But his horizon really was not much beyond being a good cop and marrying his girlfriend of 3 years named Magdalena, who was absolutely gorgeous. And this was his life, and he never realized that that kind of rather comfortable, conventional life could explode. Again, the police force was heavily Cuban, as he was second-generation Cuban, and he seemed to fit in perfectly.
Well, of course, he's a character in a Tom Wolfe novel, so what he doesn't know is he's going to get involved in some big events here. And there's this incident that sort of sets the plot in motion. Nestor is on the Marine Patrol Unit, and they get a call that this bedraggled Cuban refugee who's been dropped off by some boat has shimmied up the tall mast of a sailboat that's parked near a causeway, and he's at the top, at this bosun's chair atop this mast, pleading for someone in the causeway to help get him, because once he gets to dry land, he gets asylum, but if he's in the water, he can be sent back to Cuba. And then Nestor affects, and I won't give away all the details here, but I mean, he affects a heroic rescue of this guy, which makes him a hero. He saves the guy's life, but it also makes him a traitor in the eyes of the Cuban community, because the guy's probably going to get sent back to Cuba because he didn't make land. It's a fascinating, it's a really gripping description, and I'll let people get the details from your book. But I'm wondering, is there a particular, what inspired that incident?
It's the entire dry foot, wet foot policies of the United States government. It's not Miami. This was all done in the wake of Castro and all the people who wanted to escape from Cuba and so on. And it was a great, if you will, public relations coup and also a rather humanitarian thing to allow as many in as, you know, could be accommodated. How exactly this dry foot, wet foot thing began, that point I don't know, but if you had reached land, and this is actually for any Cuban anywhere in America, if you had reached land, you could not be sent back to Cuba. You might be prosecuted for some vile crime that you had committed, but you couldn't be sent back. And if you touched anything that is connected to the United States, like a bridge, then you were considered a dry foot. But if you came in by water and you didn't make it all the way in, you could be sent back. Actually, these people who came in as wetfoots or tried to come in would be questioned by the Coast Guard and given a chance to prove that they had left because they were in immediate danger.
One of the details that caught my eye as I was reading this, this character, Nestor Camacho, is a police officer. And you say that he learned the cop stare. What is the cop stare? Where did you observe that?
When I see it, I recognize it. And I've, you know, not all of my relationships with police have been all that polite as they have been when I'm reporting. It's a look that says, in some way, I don't know how you move the muscles, it says, look, out here on this street, I am the only authority. Once I arrest you and drag you in to the precinct, there'll be other authorities who will take over. But here on the street, I rule. That is the look. And I see it over and over again. It's a great technique for keeping the peace. In effect, it says, you don't have a chance against me. For one thing, I'm armed. And it works.
One of the memorable descriptions in this book is of something called the Columbus Day Regatta, which I hadn't heard of, but is a real thing in Miami. And I know that you visited this. You want to just tell us a little bit about this, your visit to the Columbus Day Regatta?
Yeah. I'll tell this briefly as I can. The regatta is actually a sailboat race. It ends up at a rather barren little island called Elliott Key. It's about 60 miles south of Miami. When the regatta first began, after the race, all the crews and the owners and everything would get together and have a party. Well, these parties began to get wilder and wilder, and people on the mainland began hearing about these Columbus Day regatta parties. And so when I got there, there were easily more than 1,000 boats had congregated around Elliott Key. I mean, 1,000 boats is a massive lot of structures and humanity. And they were waiting for the evening. And the police, up until recently, didn't try to control things. People would lash together boats, 12 in a row, which created one gigantic deck. You had to go up and down on the deck. And it became wilder and wilder and wilder until finally they would be showing pornographic films on the sails of schooners. And they would, in essence, have orgies right there on the decks. I couldn't believe this.
You saw this personally?
So I saw it personally. As I say, I studied this thing for a very long time. It has cooled down a bit because there is a police presence now. But nevertheless, for example, I won't go too graphic detail, but the bare breasts begin about 5:30 p.m., and then we go on from there. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Do you think it says anything about Miami culture?
Well, it probably does. John Timoney, who was deputy commissioner of police in New York, then became chief of police in Philadelphia, and then became chief of police in Miami. So he knows the East Coast pretty well. He said to me, New York is the city of money. Washington, D.C. is the city of power. Miami is the city of sex. Now, I haven't checked out all the other places to see if that's really that's really true. But there is a little bit of hedonism in the air.
When you were on this show 25 years ago, Terry Gross asked you, would you ever let somebody follow you, spend a few days with you and observe what you do and write about your technique? And at the time you said, I don't think so. But here, in fact, this reporter, Oscar Corral, who showed you around Miami, videotaped a lot and has produced a film doing just that, looking at the Tom Wolfe method. How do you feel about somebody else capturing you here?
Well, I was very grateful to him because he'd done a lot for me, and I wasn't going to say no. But I did tell him, a reporter cannot afford to have a camera around in any sort of sensitive information gathering. It just puts the other person off so badly. And that's why I've always felt that following a reporter around or following a writer around is you're going to have a lot of boring stretches with the poor guy's hunched over his desk trying to figure out what to do next, tapping his forehead. I think he did a good job. He showed me in the midst of reporting scenes.
He wrote, I believe, that you wrote this book completely by hand. Is that right?
Yes. If I had my choice, I would be writing by typewriter. I worked on newspapers for 10 years. I typed with the touch system. And unfortunately, you can't keep typewriters going today. You have to take the ribbons back to be re-inked. It's a horrible search to try to find missing parts. So I went to the computer, and the computer kept winking at me. You know, like, okay, big boy, I'm ready. Let's have some action here.
Winking like a light would flash or the screen would change?
Oh, there were these little lights that are coming on. Just to put in a piece of paper, to use typewriter talk, you have to go through about three steps. I mean, it drove me nuts. The fact is I was born too early. That's all that means.
You know, in so many of your books, you write these wonderful descriptions of characters kind of struggling in changing times. You ever picture yourself writing a description of Tom Wolfe?
Actually, I do, and I think I would write of him, Tom Wolfe, as this rather old-fashioned figure. All these damn white suits he has and all this stuff. And you ought to see his shoes. Oh, they look like spats. They're not spats, but that's the kind of thing you run into when you run into Tom Wolfe. I could do a good job of myself, I think.
You know, when you write about a character, one of the things I notice is that you're using this character to examine the particular culture or subculture in which the character lives. And one of the things I notice is that you find these subtle ways in which status and pecking order are defined in that subculture, the little things. And I'm just, how do you get that? Do you ask that question? Is it just careful observation? How cops distinguish one another, or strippers, or whoever?
This attention to status or status, however you like to pronounce it, started when I was in graduate school, and I was in a program called American Studies, which was a mixture of different disciplines, but one that you were forced to take was sociology. I'd always looked down on sociology as this Arabist discipline. They didn't have the noble history of English and history as a subject. But once I had a little exposure to it, I said, hey, here's the key. here's the key to understanding life in all of its forms. And the great theorist of, well, the status or status theorist was a German named Max Weber. From that time on, I said, this obviously is the way to analyze people in all of their manifestations. I mean, my theory is that every moment, even when you're by yourself in the bathroom, you are trying to live up to certain status requirements as if somebody were watching. I mean, anyway, you can think about it. It really is true. It's only when your life is in danger that you drop all of that.
And at 81, what are the status requirements for your life?
Well, just the last month, I've seen myself referred to, quite often, as an octogenarian. And I always say, look, that's a hobby of mine. It's not an occupation. It's something I like to do at night. I think it doesn't really matter how old you are if your health is all right and your mind hasn't gone yet.
Well, Tom Wolf, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Dave, you're more than welcome. And if you see Terry Gross, tell a hello. Just 25 short years ago that I first appeared on this program.
I promise I will.
And hello back to you, Tom Wolf, and thank you for being back on the show. Tom Wolf spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. You can read an excerpt of Wolf's new book, Back to Blood, on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.